from South Dakota Public Broadcasting. I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state of South Dakota. You can listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker to play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the Segments Podcast. And now, your weekly roundup in news coverage. As South Dakotans continue to prepare for the days ahead, we also prepare for spring. Melissa Smith is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service in Rapid City, and Mike Gillespie is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service in Sioux Falls. They joined us to give us details for the spring flood outlook.
Melissa, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Hi, thank you so much.
And Mike, thanks for being here as well.
Good morning, Ray. Thank you.
Melissa, let's start with you. Give us the big picture here, look, and then we'll dig into some of the details.
All right. Well, right now, we are watching some of our snow has been melting across the area. I mainly deal with western South Dakota, and we have Mike over in eastern South Dakota. So we'll be here to help answer, you know, any questions that you might have on our spring flood potential and what we're looking at, and kind of give you an idea of all the factors that are starting to come together and what we're looking at for this spring.
All right. Mike, big picture look, East River.
So far this spring, East River has come out as about as good as we possibly could have hoped for with the snow melt so far. It's been a nice slow melt with very little additional precipitation for the last month. So even though we are seeing some minor flooding on the Big Sioux and moderate to major flooding on the James, things could have been a lot worse than what we're seeing right now.
All right. Tell us why. For people who have short memories, what we were really, not too long ago, really worried about this spring. Not that we're not worried now, but what was happening last fall and last summer that caused some of the major concerns?
Yeah, if you look at eastern South Dakota, you know, basically last year was a record wet year. And in the southeast part of the state, southeast quarter of the state here, we've had back-to-back record wet years. So the soils are saturated, the rivers are running high, the water table, the aquifers are running high, all the lakes and ponds are full. There was just no room to store any water, additional water from snow melt or rain this spring. So as that snow was melting across the area here, it was all running off as opposed to soaking in the ground or going into the lakes and sloughs and things like that. So we've seen more runoff than normal, but luckily, like I said, the snow melt has been really slow. It's taken about 4 weeks to kind of get rid of all the snowpack around the eastern part of the state. So the runoff we've seen hasn't caused too many major problems yet, but we're definitely not out of the woods yet.
Melissa, what does the snowpack and sort of what are things looking like right now West River and in the Black Hills?
You know, we still have these really high soil moisture values, and a lot of that was from our last 2 years being just extremely wet across the area. There's been over 40 stations across the state that set record precipitation last year. So coming into this spring, we do still have those wet soils. Our snowpack has gone down quite a bit on the western plains. However, areas up in the Black Hills still have, probably around 3 feet of snow in a lot of areas. And in that snow, there's still quite a bit of water. We're looking at liquid water amounts of 3 to 6 inches in a lot of that snow up in the Black Hills. So we're just going to keep an eye on that. And typically, that would start melting out a little bit later this spring. So we're still in our accumulation season. So we're kind of watching the storm track over the next few weeks to see, you know, what additional snowpack we are going to accumulate that's going to add to any of those possible problems that we will get into this spring.
Melissa, how much snow in that March and April timeframe do we typically see? That's a high snow time or high potential there, right?
Yeah, for West River, typically March is our snowiest month, followed by April, which is our second snowiest month. And then as we get into May and June, those are typically our two wettest months for rainfall. So we're kind of watching those weather patterns pretty closely right now to see what else we're going to accumulate before we start melting some of this off.
Mike, same story, that March and April is really going to be key?
Yeah, East River, especially in the southeast, April starts seeing more of a transition into more rain than snow. But March is our snowiest month on average. You know, in Sioux Falls, we average up around 8 inches of snow in March. So any additional snowfall that we get right now, if it sits on the ground for a few days and maybe gets some rain dumped on top of it, would be kind of the worst case that, on what we'd be looking at from here forward.
All right. Say more about that as far as what do we know right now about the forecast? Because we've seen some really nice days in the southeast corner of the state. It's almost tricking you into believing that that we're out of the woods, but we're not. What are we looking for in the days ahead, Mike?
Yeah, right now we do have a couple systems. We're getting into a little bit more of an active pattern for the next week or two here, and we're looking at a couple of systems coming through that thankfully right now look like they're going to generally affect kind of along the South Dakota-Nebraska border over into northwest Iowa with the heaviest precipitation amounts. But, you know, even up towards the Brookings, Huron, down towards Chamberlain area, we're looking at about a half an inch of precipitation over the next 4 or 5 days here, and closer to an inch to inch and a half as you get down, say, south of I-90. So there is a potential for some additional moisture coming into the system. Right now, it looks like mostly snow for the South Dakota out of this next system. There could be a little bit of rain mixed in, but yeah, the big key is going to be is we don't want to start packing up another, you know, 10, 20 inches of snow over the next, you know, 3 or 4 weeks here and then have that melt off real fast with additional rainfall on top of it.
What are we seeing for ice jams?
The ice is pretty well cleared out of the rivers. You know, East River here, the James River, Big Sioux River are pretty much ice-free now. There might be a little bit of ice sitting around as you get up kind of the northeast part, say north of Highway 212 there. Might still have a little bit of ice around. But for the most part, the ice is cleared out, and we're not expecting any real issues with ice jams through the rest of the spring.
Melissa, is that the same story? West River, ice jams are pretty much cleared, or are we looking at different data?
You know, the ice is pretty much off of all the rivers. West River, we had some minor little ice jam issues last week, but as that warmer weather last week allowed a lot of that ice to get off the rivers, and that isn't much of a factor anymore.
All right, Mike, just to wrap up here, tell us what's happening currently, you know, with those places that are above flood stage. What are we seeing and where?
Yeah, as we sit right now, basically from south of Watertown, Castlewood area down through Sioux Falls here, that middle portion of the Big Sioux River has some minor flooding on most of the river gauges around there. Nothing real significant, just some farmland, you know, the lower pasture lands, that kind of stuff. The big issue right now is the James River. Basically across the entire state, we're looking at moderate to major flooding ongoing right now. Some of these areas have been in moderate flood stage since, it's basically about a year ago now, March 13th last year. Some of these areas have been above flood stage for pushing a year now. Again, luckily, there aren't very many communities that are impacted along the James River, but that's a lot of farmland and a lot of county and township roads that are still underwater, and people that live in those areas are definitely inconvenienced having to drive around all that.
Right. Well, we don't need another spring like we had last year, so we're going to hope for the best. Melissa Smith is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service Rapid City. Melissa, any final thoughts here, or are we good?
You know, the biggest thing that we want to remind folks for the spring is that, you know, we still have these high river levels and this high soil moisture. So these are things that we're going to be looking. But luckily, that river ice is off a lot of the rivers, and our frost depth is a lot lower. So some of that moisture is going to be able to get into the ground. However, if you're out there driving around and you do encounter a flooded area, just remember to turn around and don't drown.
Now, as the coronavirus spreads across the United States, doctors and healthcare workers are standing on the front line of prevention, testing, and treatment. They do this work without knowing the nature of the novel coronavirus. They do this amidst uncertainty about the availability of supplies. Dr. Jerome W. Freeman is a professor of medicine at the Sanford School of Medicine, and he joined In the Moment host Lori Walsh to talk about caring for those who care for us, and about kindness and empathy for patients who are frightened or even panicked in a pandemic.
Dr. Freeman, thanks for being here.
You're welcome.
I feel like you're the voice we particularly need to hear from now on a number of levels of medical ethics and training our doctors and protecting them. But I want to start with this idea of, you know, protective equipment for doctors and healthcare workers, the things that we're kind of learning about how they can be affected by their exposure. How do you approach a pandemic like this from that viewpoint, as far as keeping healthcare workers safe, but also working?
Well, it's very important to have adequate equipment and to know how to use it. Oftentimes, the people, if students or physicians aren't regularly using the equipment, they might need a refresher on the order you put the equipment on, how you establish that it's safe. But unfortunately, in many areas of the country, there is an inadequate supply of the equipment, and that's causing a lot of concern.
What's caused that inadequate supply? Is this something that everyone was just ill-prepared for?
Well, I think in part, many people didn't envision a global pandemic like this, and so the stores of the equipment just aren't sufficient to meet what seems to be the demand.
And how do we, what do we know about in South Dakota, how that is being coordinated now? Is there a plan for getting more?
Well, in South Dakota, I think right now we are in very good shape. Our health systems and smaller hospitals as well have been trying to forecast what they're going to need. They've been looking at their supplies. There's been good collaboration. For instance, in Sioux Falls, Avera and Sanford have been actively working together to coordinate their testing efforts. And I think in South Dakota, we are in a much better situation than in other places around the country.
Just that collaboration alone might be somewhat unprecedented in the sense that these are not necessarily organizations that work together often.
But they certainly are capable of it when cooperation is needed, and I've been very impressed with the collaboration that's taken place. This morning, I received an email from a former student. She's a resident now in the western part of the country, and it was so evident how alarmed she was. She and her husband have a 6-month-old baby, and she indicated they're feeling unprotected by their employer. They don't really feel their concerns are being listened to. They feel there's a mentality of putting their work as resident physicians ahead of their family and their little baby. So it just gives the flavor of the kind of stresses and concerns that many people are feeling at this point.
Mm. What's your advice to someone like that who is in this highly stressful job, but is also thinking about spouses and children and parents and grandparents at home?
Well, I think having a notion that we need to collaborate and to share and to really look out for each other is very, very important. Healthcare providers have always understood that there are risks with doing the job correctly. In order to care for our patients with any infectious diseases, there is always some risk undertaken of contracting an infection. With the coronavirus, unfortunately, it appears to be very contagious, and so precautions need to be heightened.
Do you feel like in South Dakota that the healthcare organizations are taking their employee concerns seriously? I know you're not listening to, you know, every closed door conversation, but in general, how is that baked into what we do at Sanford and Avera and Monument and some of the South Dakota providers?
I think all of the institutions are taking a proactive approach. For instance, at Sanford, there are regular, often twice daily communications with the physicians and staff. Yesterday, they conducted what they called a town hall for employees or in the region, and I believe over 1,000 people were in attendance, virtually in attendance, not in person. Understandably, nurses, doctors, other healthcare workers have a lot of questions, and I think the institutions have been very forthright in terms of trying to provide accurate and helpful answers.
We just heard from the White House at the Coronavirus Task Force talking about prioritization of testing and processing those tests to areas where the need is the highest. And that has a lot of people in South Dakota asking about whether or not we are a priority and where we fall in the prioritization of testing. When we've heard so much about the importance of testing, you know, to getting ahead of this and flattening the curve so people who you know they're sick can stay home and, you know, self-isolate. Talk a little bit about what that looks like in South Dakota as hospitals struggle to get tests, struggle to find the place to process them, whether they're processing them in-house or contracting with a private lab. Unpack that for us a little bit, please, Dr. Freeman.
Well, I think around the country, there has been a scramble, really, to get testing up to the levels we needed. Ideally, we would have the tests available to check millions of people, because persons who become infected are asymptomatic for a number of days, 5 days or so, and can spread the virus. So what we really need, ultimately, is sufficient tests to screen large numbers of people. The most urgent need right now is in areas that are hardest hit. And one precept that's always used in medicine is one of triaging, where you direct the resources to where they're needed the most. So in places like Washington State or in Los Angeles and certainly in New York City, their need right now is way more pressing than our need in South Dakota. Fortunately, right now, we still have a very limited number of cases, 11 I last heard, 11 or 12, and I think all of these have been from outside contacts. So we want the testing available as soon as possible, but I think our need, our urgency is somewhat less than around the country. One other point to make is I received a communication earlier this morning from indicating that Avera and Sanford will be working together and expect to have a lot more testing available this week even. So we're making good strides, I think.
Let's talk a little bit about that response. And I know kindness and empathy and ethical considerations and a more thoughtful way of doing medicine are so important to you. It's just infused in everything that you do through USD. This is an incredibly stressful time for healthcare workers because their phones are ringing off the hook. Patients are upset, you know, demanding maybe, suffering and not being able to get help. Talk a little bit about how to approach that very human aspect of this.
Well, one fundamental that we are emphasizing at our medical school is kindness. And we emphasize that kindness is so important, not only from physicians to patients, but colleagues, students to professors, to kindness to staff. We feel that kindness is an imperative that we are making, well, it's part of our new strategic plan at the medical school. And we define kindness as what we do and how we do it. So the how is acting in ways that are perceived to be helpful and kind. But kindness also demands that we use evidence-based medicine, that we take, in the case of the corona infection, we take adequate measures to protect our healthcare people. And so kindness is really important, I think, right now, especially, as you mentioned, Lori, when people are stressed, they're anxious, they get angry because of delays. And I think in that setting in particular, to have an attitude of kindness and empathy is crucially important.
There are people who, are learning now that if they can't get to their doctor, you know, how much they really rely on them for this kind of emergency or urgent care to, regular daily care. And I'm wondering if you think at this point, this is hypothetical, but do you think that it's possible for us to avoid these things that we see happening, that we're being warned about? Is it unavoidable at this point that we're going to have community spread? Is it unavoidable that we will have equipment shortages? Is it unavoidable that doctors here will have to triage people and make choices about who receives emergency care, intensive care, and who doesn't? Are those things unavoidable at this point?
I wouldn't say, Lori, that they're unavoidable, but the prospect of this pandemic getting worse regionally and nationally is very good. I mean, there have been some people who have wondered if the discussions were overblown. And I've had patients ask me, is this really that as bad as is being reported? And I would say emphatically, it is bad. It's bad. It's a very contagious virus, and it's going to spread. I think we can do a lot here locally, and it's been implemented already in our state. I mean, closing schools, closing businesses, restaurants and bars, and big gatherings of people, I think is very, very important. Good hand sanitation and social isolation really make a difference. And sometimes it's hard for people to understand and believe how important it is, but I would say these measures are crucial.
President Donald Trump also talked about the response and mentioned progress on a vaccine and an expansion of testing. Are you hearing things from the federal government that whether it's the president himself or whether it's just Dr. Deborah Birx or Anthony Fauci, are you hearing things from the public health officials through the administration that encourage you that they understand the severity of this?
I think there is a national understanding at this point. I don't think that was always the case. I mean, we can always look back and think we should have been responding more quickly. There's some things that are beyond our control. Realistically, I don't think we are going to have an effective vaccine for maybe a year and a half. It just cannot be developed more rapidly than that. Right now, though, antiviral treatments for people infected are being looked at vigorously, and there is some hope that we may come up with some ways to lessen the severity of bad infections in terms of drugs. But that a lot is being done for that. I think there's a part of all of society that has difficulty grappling with how severe something may be in the future when it isn't immediately in your region. And we're so fortunate that there are not a lot of cases in South Dakota. But I would not minimize the risk to us at all. This is a serious infection and pandemic, and we need to be very vigorous in terms of our preparation.
What's your advice to patients who are listening about the days ahead and, how they can treat themselves at home, how they should really navigate their relationship with their doctor? What's your advice for patients who are worried and who may be sick?
Well, the worry alone, not even being sick, but the worry alone can be very hard to cope with and incapacitating. But the standard advice that has been given makes sense. If a person thinks she or he actually has a corona infection, they should call and learn where to go to get tested. If a patient's symptoms are mild, self-isolation is very important. One of the most frightening things about the infection, I think, again, is the fact that people can be infected and walk around in the community and spread it unknowingly. So I think the measures that have been taken make good sense. Restaurants, I know, in Sioux Falls have been, and other places have been closed. Bars have been closed. Big community events have been canceled. all of these things, although they're hard, I think are worthwhile and ultimately going to help us.
Dr. Jerome Freeman, Professor of Medicine at the Sanford School of Medicine, University of South Dakota, we thank you so much for your time. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
We wanted to be sure to ask how this is affecting rural communities, more specifically the ag economy. So we invited on Charles Barron, he's the co-founder of Farmers Business Network, to, well, answer just that.
How are farmers handling the economic downturn and coronavirus crisis? Are there opportunities for farmers in the days ahead? What are the challenges of the upcoming spring planting season? Charles Barron is co-founder and chief innovation officer of Farmers Business Network. He joins us now on the phone. Charles Barron, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks. Great to be here.
All right. Big picture right now. There's a major time of disruption. Everybody is worried and afraid, and farmers are human beings who are also worried and afraid. But tell me a little bit about what the current environment means for farmers across the Great Plains.
Well, I would say I've been talking to dozens of farmers here this week all across the country, the Great Plains in the South, ranchers in the West, and I would say by and large, folks are pretty positive and sort of proceeding as businesses as usual. Thus far, for the most part, for farmers, the challenges that they've faced or that the corona epidemic has created in the business environment have been manageable or typical business risks for a farmer. So lower prices on the corn, hog prices going down. It's pricing pressure thus far. It hasn't been fundamental supply chain disruption. So, for the most part, every, farm I've talked to is, they're obviously very concerned about all the challenges out there, but they're very committed to getting the crop planted and ready to get planting here in a month and a half or so and able to do so. And so I would say, farmers are pretty robust bunch and are plowing ahead.
All right. So social distancing and isolation and quarantine, that all looks somewhat different when you're a farmer or when you're in rural America. Tell us a little bit about, are they concerned about staying healthy so that they can get the crop in?
Absolutely. I think they are. I think, farmers will tell you, I've seen some making light of it in a sense saying, social distancing is perfect for when you need to be in a tractor 10 hours a day during planting. So farmers are already have a little bit of a buffer there built in that the most of the rest of us may not have and, benefit from all the space and acreage on their properties. They're, of course, worried about health just like anyone. But I think they have some built-in advantages to the nature of the lifestyle that will help them throughout.
All right, so let's talk about what's in demand. And as we see the financial picture shift from the federal government, what's happening there?
Well, the crisis and the challenges in the economy are also creating some big opportunities for farms in a couple areas. I mean, so on the oil price side, obviously, that's had an impact on ethanol and ethanol demand. But for farmers wanting to lock in fuel contracts, these are pretty unprecedented times to lock in very low-priced fuel contracts. On financing, one big thing here that's been going on is that the Federal Reserve has lowered rates. That's directly been able to be passed through to certain parts of the farm credit system for farmers who are refinancing or wanting to finance on land and operating lines of credit. And we've seen a just enormous surge of demand from growers across the country, for refinancing. So, for example, on land now, we're able to offer rates that are below 2%, so 1.86% on our lowest level. And that has, we've seen, in the last week, basically a 25-fold increase in the amount of interest in refinancing from across the country from farmers. So it's really been enormous in terms of, I think, farmers looking to take advantage of this. It isn't a real opportunity for them to take advantage of the savings that are available. And, and many are doing so.
So help people do some math here when we talk about the rates going down and what that can mean for farmers as they, give us an example or, kind of talk some of those numbers so people can make a decision. Is this the thing to do for me right now?
Well, I think you have to look, if you own land and you're interested in refinancing on it, it can be a great opportunity to take advantage of it. We sort of look at it in terms of what type of savings might be available there versus, 15 months ago, if you'd financed 15 months ago. And the math that in our system is, if you'd financed a typical 1,000-acre, corn soybeans operation in terms of the typical land value you might see, the interest rates have dropped nearly 2 points since that time. And that savings would be on an annualized basis almost $60,000. So there could be very substantial savings out there. But even if you're refinancing a much smaller amount of land, even just a few acres or, a quarter or so, typical plot, there's real savings out there can be a good thing for farmers to look at right now.
When we talk about financing, I think most farmers, understand this, but talk a little bit, if you would, about avoiding scams and going through trusted sources, because, we're hearing stories of people being contacted and offered deals that are not legitimate. So just a few seconds about, knowing who you're working with. It's a good reminder for everybody, knowing what email that you're opening.
That's right. That's right. I think there's, across the board, there's all kinds of, things going on right now in terms of, companies posing as other companies those types of scams. But especially in the financial world, make sure you're working with an accredited lender or you're working with someone who is, has accredited partnerships in the Farm Credit System or with Farmer Mac, with the major providers, because it is a highly regulated, industry, and there are only certain players who are able to operate. So that's a basic set of due diligence that, of course, everybody should do when they receive any kind of contact or solicitation.
Always a good reminder when things are, people get flustered and worried and panicked. Let's talk a little bit about Farmers Business Network's hubs across the nation in South Dakota. Tell me what's new in that area.
Well, a big thing that we started doing this year is everyone has known FBN as e-commerce, and we've always at our core we're a virtual company. We connect about 10,700 farms around the U.S. and Canada, and we've been able to enable farmers to purchase things like seed and chemicals online, which right now a lot of farmers are doing out of they've done out of comfort and convenience, and now they're doing also out of safety. This year we rolled out close to over 70 hubs around the United States, and these are local facilities that are warehouses farmers can pick up from, so they can get e-commerce savings, but do it in a way where they can pick up locally, and that hub is operated and run by one of FBN's farmer members. So they're directly going into business and working with one of our farmer partners around the country. So we've created a number in South Dakota. Of course, with all the concerns right now, we're adopting all CDC guidelines on health and safety and sanitation, and making sure that our facilities and our contacts and the way in which farmers pick up product or have product delivered to them is done in as hygienic and safe a way as possible. So it's really created a great alternative for growers who now can pick up locally, but still get all the savings that, e-commerce can bring them.
All right. Let's talk about farmers getting ready for planting now after a late harvest. And we're talking, of course, we had our flood outlook report earlier in the week. What are some of the things ahead for farmers as they get ready for a new season?
Well, I think, this is normally the time in which, growers are really getting their equipment dialed in and getting their planter ready and preparing for any spring fertilizer application that they have to do. And I think, one of the big things now that I think people are looking at is, making sure they have access to all their inputs, everything they needed or were expecting to have delivered. A big thing for us has been we've ensured that all the inputs through our system are here. They're in the U.S. They're in our facilities. So there's, you know, we don't want any supply chain disruptions to farmers as they go to plant. I think we're going to get a lot of, you know, support around that in terms of ag is a critical industry. It's a vital industry. Food production will, of course, continue. So making sure that everyone has access to the products they need is really something farmers should make sure they double check all their purchases that they've been doing and make sure what they expect to be showing up is going to be there. We're there for them, and we're making sure that can happen throughout our supply chain.
Now, as South Dakotans seek information regarding COVID-19 in South Dakota, we gathered the Dakota Political Junkies for an update on state politics, including government leadership and government partnerships in this time of disruption. Mike Card is a political science professor at the University of South Dakota, and Tom Dempster is a former state lawmaker. They joined Lori Walsh to give us an overview about what's going on in Pierre.
Hey, Mike, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad that you're here as well. And Tom Dempster is also with us on the phone, a former state lawmaker. Hey, Tom, welcome back.
Lori, good to talk to you. Mike, nice to talk to you.
All right.
Nice to talk to you, Tom.
Let's get started with leadership at this point, because this is a time when, political leaders, governors, presidents, individual lawmakers have an opportunity to rise to the occasion. Mike Card, I want to start with you and Governor Kristi Noem and the response that she's had to the coronavirus pandemic and how it will impact South Dakota. What are your thoughts on her leadership so far?
Well, I think, first of all, Governor Noem is demonstrating that she recognizes the interdependencies. Action in one sphere has consequences in another sphere. So I think her reaching out and in getting Avera and Sanford, as well as Regional Health out West River, to work together with public health sources has been fabulous. The CDC director of infectious disease noted that if people are complaining that you're too draconian, your response is about right. I think she's balanced the response fairly well.
Yeah. If it looks like you're overdoing it, you're doing it right. That's Tom Dempster, your thoughts on the leadership? We've had a little time in South Dakota, and that's a great benefit to us to sort of get plans into place, but it's also a challenge because we have 11 positive cases, and you're asking for a lot with schools closing and basketball tournaments canceled. So that also presents a sort of a leadership challenge to say, look, this is why we're doing this, and this is why we're doing it now, and it really matters that we do it together. Your thoughts, Tom?
Lori, I'm going to agree with Mike. Lori, I'm going to agree with you. And I always talk that public service is something that you do that is of the highest order of service to mankind. I think you have to recognize the extreme difficulty of the job. And this is true whether you're a governor, whether you're a mayor, whether you're a county commissioner, whether you're in the state legislature. Any elected official is standing right in the midst of this, in the midst of this crisis. Anticipating that question, I watched the press conferences of the governor in California, and I watched press conferences of the governor in Washington, and then, of course, watched Governor Noem's press conferences. And here's what I saw in all of those press conferences. I saw an extraordinary degree of confidence. I saw competence. All of that was mixed with a sense of equanimity, and absolutely with a sense of grace. And I know this sounds too idealistic. Or may sound too idealistic, but whether the governor of California or the governor of Washington or the governor of South Dakota, I saw each of them standing there with all of this stress as if it was an act of love. Mm-hmm. Quite incredible.
Tom, as a former state lawmaker, we're starting to see lawmakers tweeting out things, you know, on their individual Twitter accounts. What's your advice to state lawmakers on, you know, how they can respond right now? I know I've been very careful about anything I tweeted out or put on Facebook that was personal right now, because people are looking to me as a journalist for really one thing. So I've streamlined my communication, you know, so it's not really about my family or, you know, what's happening to me personally. Right. As a former lawmaker, what's the individual lawmakers, what's your advice to them about how they handle their communications with constituents in small town South Dakota and with social media in the larger world?
We have, this crisis is in my mind, has four stages to it. The first is recognizing where we are. The second is preparing for the onslaught. The third is endure the onslaught when it inevitably comes. And then finally recover. And all of those things require that we simply pull all of our resources together. And that goes back to my original statement, Lori, is that I do believe that holding public office is of the highest order of service. And that means it's your responsibility to find public policy that works, and absolutely your responsibility to pull this community together. Hmm.
Mike Card, any thoughts on from you on those individual lawmakers and the response? I know Governor Noem had a town hall talking with lawmakers. What are your thoughts on that? Those lawmakers' responsibility and opportunity at this time?
Well, I have a slightly different role, and I'm going to try to relate that. When I'm working with my students who I'm dealing with remotely, I at first translated the research and the public policy to them and realized, you know, if we're going to give credible, accurate, consistent information, my best bet is actually to link them to the appropriate information rather than risk my mistranslating the information. But I think Tom is exactly right to recognize where we are and to realize we don't know where we are because of the shortage of tests, but we are preparing. And I think the messages that he recognized from the governors of the states to exhibit confidence that we can make it through this if we work together, and competence that we have public servants, both elected and appointed, who are in place, and to recognize that we need to give each other a little bit of grace. Mm. You know, as a result of several public health emergencies over time, our legislature and governors in the past and dedicated public servants have set up an emergency response. Public health, epidemiology, and emergency response all work together. I have great confidence we'll make it through this. There will be problems. Right. You know, the interdependencies of stopping the spread of the coronavirus or COVID-19 is going to create economic hardship for people. But if we don't stop the spread of the virus, well, we may not be around to recover.
Yeah. Tom Dempster, obviously a huge burden on people, adding to the stress and to the real life day-to-day challenges of even buying groceries, is what's happening in the stock market, what's happening to people's portfolios, people who are living on, you know, retirement, you know, payouts every month are seeing them shrink. People, you know, who are you know, just starting investing or having savings account, there's a huge financial burden here for businesses and for individuals. With your experience as a financial planner, have you seen anything like this before? Can you relate it to anything else? Or are we in, I keep hearing this word unprecedented, and I'm a little tired of it already. Is this unprecedented from the economic standpoint, Tom?
Here's the good news.
Oh, yay. Just pause for a minute. There's going to be good news.
Yeah.
Everybody tune in. Go ahead.
Seriously. The best according to advisors that I pay a great deal of attention to. Do you know what the best performing stock market is in the world today?
I do not.
China. That means when this summer is over, that this should be a temporary event. We will get this in hand. This, in my opinion, is nothing like the financial crisis that we endured. Had that taken force, I'm not so certain that we would be having a conversation today. This is nothing like that at all. This is something that is temporary. This is something that is very serious, is life-threatening, especially for vulnerable populations. But have I seen market free falls like this in my life before? Oh, let me count them. Once, twice, three times, four times, five times, probably six times in my career.
Okay. Hold on for the ride, investors. There are economically vulnerable people as well that have challenges that, you know, here I am at work, I'm collecting a paycheck, I'm allowed to work, they've created a safe space for me at work to keep things as germ-free as possible. There are many people who don't have that advantage. Tom, are you hearing from the White House, from the Fed, are you hearing from the Treasury Department? Are you hearing the kinds of things from Congress that you think that they get that and they're taking action? Or do you think more needs to be done more quickly?
Let's hope that, I mean, we've done, I think, much of what we can do with monetary policy. Mm-hmm. That's oxygen. And that's oxygen to the economy. And we need oxygen to the economy for sure. We're now hearing conversations that first started with Romney a couple of days ago, as a matter of fact, of distributing $1,000 checks to everyone. This goes right back to some decades ago to Milton Friedman, the University of Chicago economist, to President Richard Nixon, and to Senator George McGovern, that felt that the best welfare policy that we should have is a negative income tax. We even heard that in this most recent presidential debate. Getting $1,000 in everybody's hands in the next couple of weeks is exactly what we need to do. Let's hope that we can get it done.
Now, if you've been on the internet at all in the last week or so, you've seen a photo of an empty toilet paper aisle. People scrambling and taking as much as they can off the shelves. And it doesn't just end there for grocery stores. Grocery stores across the country are now taking new measures to help prevent the spread of COVID-19 and help the immunocompromised and elderly populations get the supplies they need. Not to mention, grocery store workers themselves are suddenly finding themselves on the front lines in the coronavirus outbreak. Tina Potthoff is Vice President of Communications at Hy-Vee Incorporated. She joined Lori to talk about some of the trends she's seeing in the industry.
Tina, we know you're very busy, so we really appreciate your time here for South Dakota Public Broadcasting listeners.
Thank you very much for having me on today. I appreciate being able to talk to everyone.
Tell us first how Hy-Vee is responding to some of the panic buying that we saw early on here in South Dakota regarding fears about coronavirus. How did workers and store managers really pull together to manage that?
Well, it's definitely been interesting and unprecedented as we've all been experiencing this pandemic and our response to it and how the American people are responding to it, too, with their dollars and what they're doing at the retail level and the grocery level. The biggest thing that we initially saw was when the announcement first came out, there was panic and people went to the stores to buy up as much as they could to do the stockpiling for 2 weeks at a time. But, you know, there has been word that's been coming out saying that grocery stores will keep their doors open. And I think that's providing people with more comfort, especially as we proceed into the days ahead. We're starting to see people experience more They're still massively buying, but we're starting to see that even off a little bit as they realize I've got plenty of toilet paper. I've got plenty of frozen food items. I have plenty of canned good items. And so what we're starting to see is while the buying still is high, people are starting to level off and realize that I have plenty of items at home and I need to start going back to my normal shopping behavior. It's very similar to this COVID virus that we're watching with the cyclical cycle, right? You start to reach a peak and then you start to level off. And so essentially with grocery shopping, we're seeing the same thing. People are starting to level off their buying.
Is there a way to prepare for things that you predict in certain areas? So if we have an area, you know, a community, a state like South Dakota, where the infection rate is not incredibly high yet, mostly because we don't have the testing. We don't really have those accurate numbers. But can you look into the future and say, you know, we think people are going to stockpile this or that or the other thing and prepare for it? Or is it more responsive?
What we've been seeing is that a lot of people are concerned with purchasing bottled water, rice, macaroni and cheese. We've also seen the toilet paper. We've seen cold and flu items that have been more at-demand items at our stores. The biggest thing I want people to know is what we're encountering isn't a supply issue, and it's an excessive demand issue. So we're still receiving supply from our suppliers. They're still producing like they normally would, but you can only go so far with trying to meet the level of demand. So they tap out at a certain point when it comes to their capacity because they're producing at maximum capacity. So right now what we're seeing is we're getting the typical levels and we're asking for more and continue to ask for more, as is every retail in the country, for certain supplies. And we're getting some in certain areas, but in most of the cases, we're getting the normal amount that we've been allocated, and then we're getting that shipped to our stores as quickly as possible.
Tell me a little bit about efforts to protect employees, because those employees are they're not trained doctors and nurses, and suddenly the one place everybody has to go is their local grocery store, whether they have symptoms or not, sometimes, depending on a family situation.
Well, the biggest thing that we want to do is protect the health and safety of not only our employees, but also our customers, too. So we are starting to do things differently in the grocery store. What you used to see in the bulk food items where people could scoop up a bag of, jelly beans or maybe milk duds or malt balls, that's no longer available. Also, when you go in and you try and grab a donut, the donut case has been closed off and everything is prepackaged. When you go into our convenience stores or our dining areas, you're going to see that those dining areas are closed. We're taking that as precaution. And in our convenience stores, you won't be able to go in and refill your own mug. We want you to take a new coffee cup or a new plastic cup and be able to fill that for the time being. So we are implementing other measures. There are other things, too. We might have convenience stores that would normally serve popcorn that people could go in and get on their own. And we've stocked those things because we want to take every single measure that we can. The biggest thing I think that you'll start to see in our stores across our 8-state region is that we have purchase plexiglass shields that will go at the checkout lanes over the next couple of days. They've started to be installed in the Des Moines area. They'll be installed across all of our 8 states in the upcoming days at our stores. And this is the part of the grocery store where you really can't have enough space. You're just kind of locked in there going through the checkout. So the cashier is in one location and the customers in another, and there is never an area where you can actually have more space than you really want. So we've installed a plexiglass shield that will be, it's a slight barrier. It's a temporary barrier as we're all going through this time, but it will be in front of the customer and also be in front of the cashier. So as you're doing the transaction, you do have a little bit more of a barrier that's there versus just relying and keeping your fingers crossed on the spacing issues. So social distancing, we're trying to practice that in our store too. But in any place in the store, you can maintain that distance when you're walking around the store. The checkout line's a little bit different.
Do you tell me a little bit about different hours, changing hours? Some of those, so hours are being adjusted for restocking, and some are being offered to people who are in the more vulnerable population. What can you tell me about that?
Sure. So our typical store hours have now gone to 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Across our 8-state region at our main grocery stores. The other thing is our convenience stores are still the normal time slots that they have been since before this even began. So those have not changed. You can still get your gas and other snacks and other items at the normal times that you would. We did open up all of our stores from 7 until 8 a.m. for three populations of individuals. One will be pregnant moms, those who are over the age of 60, and anyone who considers themselves to be at risk, at a higher risk for this particular disease. We do know that there are many Americans that have various diseases or ailments that may consider them to be more at risk. And so that hour in the morning from 7 to 8 is when they can stop by our stores. Our pharmacies will be open at that time as well.
Delivery? Is Hy-Vee still delivering in the communities that it delivers to?
We are. That's a really good thing to mention right now, because as you can imagine, the demand for our aisles online service has skyrocketed here recently. We were starting to see just in general a trend towards more people shopping online over the past several months before we even hit coronavirus. But now what we're seeing is that a massive influx of brand new customers are coming to our aisles online site and trying to do their shopping there. We are working with third-party providers in many markets. I wouldn't say all of them, but many markets where we're working with people like DoorDash or Shipt to be able to make those deliveries for us so that we can continue to fill the orders at the stores. We also are opening up additional pickup slots at the stores so customers can come by and pick up their groceries. And I do encourage our customers to please check the website first for times of pickups and deliveries before they start placing their order, because that's an easier way to see if there are time slots available for the time that you want versus placing the order and then selecting the time slot.
Tell us a little bit about the ban on reusable bags, because some people are needing help making the connection. It seems like if the bag comes from my house, I have an understanding of its germ exposure, but a bag from the store is a bag from the store. Tell us why that decision was made, please.
Sure. So we know that when we're packaging with, and we want to make sure we're keeping our sustainability initiatives first and foremost. I mean, we all feel the same way, right? You know, reusable bags have definitely been in that category of sustainability. But we're in different times right now. We have to do what's best to protect the health and safety of our customers and employees. So what we've done is we've temporarily banned the use of reusable bags at our stores. We will give you a fresh bag, whether it be paper or plastic, at our stores, so that those individuals get a brand new fresh bag that no one has touched other than the bagger who's bagging your groceries, and you know that your groceries are safe. With regards to reusable bags, we've just seen some reusable bags that maybe haven't been washed the best way that they could, or we really don't know where the reusable bag has come from. So to protect the safety of our employees too, and also the fact that that reusable bag is sitting at the same place where you'd have a normal bag, we want to make sure that we're using due diligence in that area.
Tell me a little bit about your efforts for employees, and then I know you are very busy, so we'll let you go after this one. But talking to your employees about, you know, staying home if they have symptoms, you know, when you work in a job where everything is very, very important right now, it's so important that they show up for work, it might be tempting to, you know, to have a fever in the morning and just say, you know, I've got to get there. Talk about communication with employees about their own wellness and how they can prevent bringing that to the store and other employees.
Right. Our employees understand that at this point in time, they are really a first responder of some sort, right? I mean, we're essentially an emergency service, a critical need that people are relying on, that we stay healthy ourselves so that we can service our customers. We have talked tirelessly with our employees about this, and we also do a regular walk around to the stores just to make sure everybody's doing okay, not only from a health standpoint, but from a mental standpoint too. This is a lot for everyone, for our customers, for our employees. And so we want to make sure that everyone's being able to handle it correctly. But we especially want to make sure that our employees are staying safe and that they know if they have any symptom whatsoever, even a minor cold, that they're required to stay at home and not be at the store. So we continuously do walk arounds and make sure that our employees are indeed healthy.
That's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. If you're looking for an individual segment, again, you can find those segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. If you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. The In the Moment podcasts are produced by myself for Lori Walsh and Steve Zwemke and Chris Loffrey. Thanks for listening. Stay healthy, everybody.